Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're getting into something that, well, it feels like a really core frustration for a lot of us. It's this paradox. You know, the feeling that everyday life is just choked by rules, endless rules, but then somehow the powerful, the well-connected, they seem to operate in a completely different reality, almost lawless.
That's a good way to put it. The constant tension, micromanaged in small ways, but seeing big things slide.
Exactly. So our mission today is a deep dive into this. We want to unpack where these rules come from, what they're supposed to do, and where they seem to go so spectacularly wrong. We'll be drawing on some key thinkers here, people like Barry Lamb and Philip K. Howard.
And, you know, if you're listening, you probably don't need convincing about the problem itself. You feel it. That constant struggle with bureaucracy, trying to navigate systems that seem to regulate, well, almost every aspect of life.
Oh, definitely.
It's not just annoying, is it? It's this systematic drain. It costs time, energy.
It really is. And the sources we looked at have some just perfect high-impact examples that capture this feeling. Like, there's this writer on Long Island, lives in a multi-generational household. Okay,
right.
He's got these two old broken down sheds and a garage on his property. Logically, you'd think, okay, maybe I can fix these up, turn them into a home office, maybe a space for the kids. Makes sense.
Seems reasonable.
But the rules just stop him dead in his tracks. He talks about this half century long saga.
50 years.
Well, okay, maybe not him personally for 50 years, but the history of the zoning on his property involves setbacks, applications that expired years ago, permits needed for retrozoning and upzoning.
Wow. And just to clarify for listeners, retrozoning is like changing the rules for structures already there.
Exactly. And upzoning means changing how intensely you can use the land. So it's this absolute bureaucratic nightmare just to do something sensible with existing structures on his own property.
And it happens in smaller, almost sillier ways too, doesn't it? The sources mentioned that bowling alley.
Oh, the we card everyone rule.
Yes.
Yeah. So the bartender has to like make a big show of checking the ID of someone who's clearly middle-aged, maybe got gray hair.
Just pure performance of following a rule, even when it makes no sense.
Right. Or the couple who couldn't get their COVID booster.
Yeah.
They wanted it. They qualified for it. But some administrative snag, some rule somewhere blocked them.
It's maddening. Oh. And then there's that academic meeting example.
Oh, that one. It's classic. Okay, so you've got an academic meeting, needs coffee and maybe some pastries, right? Needs it for 9:30 a.m.
Standard stuff.
But the university rules say they have to use this one specific catering company.
Oh, yeah.
And that company, they don't start work until 10 a.m.
So no coffee when the meeting starts.
Exactly. So the organizer says, look, there's a Starbucks right nearby, opens at 7:30. Can't we just order from there? Sensible, right?
Seems logical.
Nope. Administrator says no. Why? Because the process must be followed. Doesn't matter if the process makes the meeting start late and uncaffeinated. The rule itself is the point, not the outcome.
The process defeats the goal. It's Kafka-esque.
It really is. And what's fascinating, truly, is that this frustration, and it comes from dealing with government, sure, but also banks, wireless carriers, schools, insurance companies, you name it, it's actually created this rare thing. A genuine across-the-aisle consensus.
Yeah, that's striking. People from different political viewpoints seem to agree. American life is just too rule-bound.
The trend is away from just, you know, trusting people or using informal ways to sort things out and towards more and more explicit rules in their enforcement.
And we should probably unpack the two main voices our sources highlight here, because they come at this from pretty different places, ideologically speaking.
Good idea. So first, from a more progressive perspective, you have the philosopher Barry Lamb. His focus is largely on the criminal justice system.
Right. Lamb looks at things like rigid mandatory sentencing guidelines or these must-arrest mandates for police in certain situations.
What's the impact there?
Well, he argues they essentially strip away human judgment from judges and police officers. They force these public servants to act more harshly, perhaps, than their own sense of justice or the specifics of the situation might warrant. Discretion gets squeezed out.
Okay, so that's one angle. Then from a more conservative viewpoint, you've got the analyst Philip K. Howard.
Yeah, Howard's lens is much more on bureaucracy and infrastructure. He paints this picture of workplaces totally tangled up in unbelievably thick HR handbooks and complex union contracts.
And infrastructure.
That's a big one for him. He details how vital projects, bridges, roads, you name it, get delayed for decades. Often by what seem like frivolous legal challenges or environmental requirements that go way beyond common sense.
So different focus areas, criminal justice versus bureaucracy, but They both land on this idea that the sheer volume of rules is preempting necessary human judgment.
Exactly. Which brings us right back to that paradox we started with. While regular people you know, the doctor hassled by the insurance company, the principal tied up by union processes are getting micromanaged.
The powerful seem to be playing by different rules. Or no rules.
Right. You see examples like a president potentially using the National Guard in ways that feel like intimidation. Or a super wealthy person finding ways to shield billions from taxes. Or, you know, political parties redrawing voting districts overnight.
It feels like there's one set of constraints for most of us, and another much looser set, or maybe a set that can be manipulated for those at the top.
And the analysis in the sources suggests it's not just that they're ignoring the law. It's that the complexity, the sheer number of rules, actually becomes a tool for them.
Oh, so?
Well, if you have vast resources, you can hire armies of lawyers who understand this incredibly complex system. They can find the loopholes, use the procedures, weaponize the process itself.
Mm-hmm.
The complexity becomes a shield.
Okay, that's a pretty bleak picture,
yeah.
Which makes you ask the really basic question, why? Why do we even have all these detailed rules covering so much of life if this is where it leads?
That's the fundamental question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to get at that, it's helpful to go way back, like ancient China.
Yeah.
To the philosopher Han Fei. He was a key figure in legalism, writing way back in the 3rd century BCE, during the Warring States period, a really chaotic time.
And what was his take on rules?
For Han Fei, it boiled down to a personnel problem. How do you govern effectively, especially when your state gets large? You can't rely on always having virtuous, brilliant leaders.
Because most people aren't brilliant.
Exactly. Han Fei was pretty pragmatic, maybe even a bit cynical. He saw most people, rulers included, as basically mediocre. Statistically, truly excellent people are rare, and their influence might be temporary.
So you can't build a system that depends on finding geniuses all the time.
Right. You can't tie the big outcomes you want, like stability, development, resolving conflicts, fairly to the tenuous and changeable quality of the individuals in charge. So what's the solution?
Rules.
Detailed, prescriptive rules.
Yeah.
For Han Fei, rules were the way to ensure a baseline level of competence, a sort of predictable, acceptable performance, no matter who happened to be sitting in the official's chair. It was about effectiveness and reliability at scale.
Okay, so that's the legalist view, rules for effectiveness. How does that compare to, say, Western thought?
Well, Western thinkers often came at it from a different angle. They were maybe less focused purely on effectiveness and more concerned with legitimacy.
Meaning?
Meaning, rules were seen as the essential alternative to arbitrary, despotic power. Rule by law, not rule by whim, it makes government more justifiable, more moral, in a sense.
And they talked about specific values rules provide.
Yeah, two core ideas often come up. First, the guidance value rules tell citizens what's expected, how to act, what the consequences are, predictability.
Okay.
And second, the process value rules tell the government how it's supposed to act. They constrain the state, promote fairness, transparency. It stops the ruler just making things up.
So rules are meant to guide us and limit arbitrary power, but obviously something goes wrong.
Seriously wrong. And one key problem is how rules tend to accumulate. They're often created in response to some specific problem, right? A defensive measure.
Like we need a rule so that never happens again.
Exactly. But once a rule is on the books, it's incredibly hard to get rid of. So the total number just grows and grows and grows.
And when you have too many rules.
Well, first, that guidance value gets totally eroded. Nobody can possibly know all the rules. It's just confusing.
And it creates weird situations, right? The sources called them edge cases.
Yes, where the rules clash or lead to absurd outcomes.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're back to arbitrary decisions just in a different way.
Like the examples they gave. The boardwalk one.
Oh, yeah. Bikes and rollerblades are banned because of some specific incident decades ago. But scooters and skateboards, totally fine. Makes no logical sense now. It's just historical accident frozen in rules.
Or getting your car towed because night officially begins 30 minutes before sunset and you just didn't know that specific weird definition.
Right. You become an unintentional lawbreaker because of some obscure detail.
And that university example, again, the student whose history of protest movements course didn't count for their teaching certification.
Because it was taught in the sociology department, not the history department, even if the content was relevant. So they had to go to night school to take essentially the same material just to tick a bureaucratic box.
The rule completely missed the original point, which was ensuring teachers have historical knowledge.
And this is where that complexity becomes dangerous. It allows rules to turn into these hidden levers of power for people who do understand the system or can afford lawyers who do.
That Bayonne Bridge example from Philip K. Howard really illustrates this, doesn't it?
It's a powerful one. Okay, so the Port Authority needed to raise the roadway of the Bayonne Bridge by 64 feet so these massive new cargo ships could fit underneath.
Sounds important for the economy. And they were using the existing foundations, right? So not like building a whole new bridge?
Correct. Minimal environmental impact, you'd think. But the required process still took 5 years and generated a 20,000-page environmental assessment.
20,000 pages, including things like exhibits on historic buildings nearby.
Yep. The administrative burden was just immense. But that wasn't even the main delay. The real blockage came from lawsuits challenging whether that massive assessment was adequate.
And who is behind the lawsuits?
According to the source material, the legal challenge was funded by the Teamsters Union. And their reported goal wasn't really environmental protection.
What was it then?
They allegedly hoped to use the delay, the years tied up in court, as leverage. A bargaining chip to pressure the Port Authority into banning independent non-union truckers from the port.
Wow. So the environmental review process, designed for one purpose, got completely weaponized by an outside group for a totally unrelated labor dispute.
Exactly. The process itself became the weapon.
Mm.
But this kind of thing, this erosion of integrity, it also happens inside organizations.
You mean with the by-the-book bureaucrats?
Yeah. People for whom following the rule, ticking the box, becomes the entire job. The decision isn't about achieving a good outcome anymore. It's just about correctly applying the rule, no matter how nonsensical the result. Process becomes an end in itself.
And this leads to some really ethically troubling situations, particularly in the justice system.
Definitely. The legal scholar Thea Johnson talks about this phenomenon she calls fictional pleas.
What does that mean?
It happens when you have those really rigid sentencing guidelines we mentioned earlier, the ones Lamb critiques. Sometimes those guidelines demand a sentence that everyone involved, the judge, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, feels is excessively harsh, unjust for the actual situation.
So what do they do?
They essentially conspire to get around the rule.
Cool.
They agree on a plea bargain to a lesser, sometimes entirely fictional crime, one that carries the sentence they all think is actually appropriate.
Can you give an example?
Sure. The source mentions a scenario. Maybe the defendant actually possessed 1,000 grams of cocaine, which triggers a very long mandatory sentence. But perhaps that sentence would mean, say, a mother losing custody of her child permanently, which feels disproportionate. So everyone might agree that she pleads guilty to possessing only 10 grams of fiction, because that charge carries a sentence that achieves what they see as the just outcome, like keeping her family together.
But they're basically agreeing to a lie in court.
That's the troubling part. They undermine the fundamental principle of the courtroom swearing to tell the whole truth. Instead, the implicit oath becomes, I swear to say whatever narrative gets us to the outcome we think is right. It's a profound compromise of principle born out of overly rigid rules.
It's quite a dilemma. And it's important to remember, as the sources point out, that these rigid rules didn't come from nowhere. They were often a reaction to earlier problems.
That's a crucial point. Before the 1980s, for instance, we had indeterminate sentencing giving judges huge amounts of discretion.
Which sounded flexible, but...
But it led to massive inconsistencies. Sentences varied wildly depending on the judge. And worse, it resulted in systemic inequalities, particularly racial disparities. So the move towards guidelines was meant to fix that real problem.
So it's this cycle. Too few rules leads to unfairness and chaos, so we create too many rules, which leads to rigidity and absurdity, and then people start breaking the rules just to get back some common sense and flexibility.
That seems to be the pattern, which naturally leads to the question, is what's the alternative?
Yeah.
Is there a middle path? How do we get the right degree of rules?
And both Lamb and Howard offer some ideas here, focused on bringing back judgment and discretion, but in smarter ways.
Right. Lamb, for instance, suggests maybe rules don't always need to be hyper-specific. Maybe sometimes vagueness is actually a good thing.
How would that work?
He gives a simple domestic example, updating his daughter's chore list. Instead of listing every single task, make bed, put clothes away, vacuum floor, he changed it to a more general principle. Keep rooms in reasonable order.
Which allows for context and judgment.
Exactly. It empowers the person doing the chore to decide what's needed in that specific situation. He also proposes something interesting for workplaces. Discretionary budgets.
Like money.
No, not money, but like a budget of exceptions. A junior employee might officially be allowed to override the rule book, say, 3 times a month. A senior manager might have 10 exceptions.
What's the point of that?
Does two things. It gives people an official way to handle situations where the rules don't make sense, but it also creates data. If everyone is constantly using their exceptions on the same rule, that's a clear signal to management. Hey, this rule needs fixing. It builds in a feedback loop.
Okay, that's Lamb's approach, more flexibility within the rules. What about Howard?
Howard advocates for something maybe even more radical. Basically, jettisoning the huge prescriptive rule books altogether.
And replace them with what? Anarchy?
No, replace them with general principles and strong auditors.
Okay, explain that.
His prime example is a reform in Australian nursing homes. They apparently had these massive, incredibly detailed rule books specifying everything. Quality wasn't great.
So they threw out the rule books.
They replaced them with just 31 general principles. Things like the home must provide a home-like environment or ensure residents have dignity. Broad goals.
And how did they ensure compliance?
Through auditors. Accountability wasn't based on checking off hundreds of tiny rules, but on assessing the overall quality based on those general principles. And apparently, quality improved dramatically.
That sounds, well, it relies a lot on the auditors, doesn't it?
Hugely. But Howard points to a historical parallel here in the U.S., Harry Hopkins during the New Deal.
Right, running the relief programs.
Hopkins apparently approved sometimes 100 infrastructure projects a day, based largely on his judgment and Bree's proposals. The philosophy was speed and trust up front.
But how did they prevent waste or fraud?
They audited after the fact. They checked later to make sure the money was spent wisely. But the initial decision-making was freed from bureaucratic sludge. Trust, then verify.
So both Lamb and Howard want more discretion, more judgment. But that comes with risks, right?
Absolutely. If you give individuals more power to use judgment, you also give them more power to abuse it. The legitimacy of that kind of system would depend entirely on making decisions visible, transparent.
And having those auditors or some accountability mechanism be really rigorous and effective.
Exactly. It shifts the burden from writing perfect rules up front to actively monitoring and holding people accountable for the outcomes of their judgments.
When you step back and look at all this, the sources really push you towards thinking about the moral side of it all.
Yeah, there's talk about the waterfall method of decision-making. You know, rules are made in one place, often far removed, and the consequences just cascade downwards, often with no feedback loop for the people affected.
And the argument is that society collectively is morally responsible for the harm those poorly designed or overly rigid rules can cause.
That seems to be the bottom line. Having way too many rules, or rules that are too complex, doesn't actually create order. It creates its own kind of lawlessness.
Where the rules bind the ordinary person, the well-meaning person, but actually become tools or shields for the powerful and the manipulative.
Which forces us back towards relying on individual human judgment.
Yeah.
It feels like a lesser of two evils situation, maybe, unless we can figure out how to really effectively blend rules, those broader principles Howard talks about, and that crucial element of human discretion.
Which brings us to a final thought, something for you, the listener, to maybe chew on. If we agree, we probably need some rules about the meta rules about how we apply discretion or interpret principles.
Mm-hmm.
How could we actually design those rules about using the rules so that they intentionally make space for human judgment, actively support it, rather than trying and probably failing to replace it entirely?